This is a recording of the first chapter of the book Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge, Vanguard Press, New York. Copyright 1952. It's being recorded by her great-nephew Frank Owen of San Luis Obispo, California. First chapter. Out of Greece into Turkey. Purely by accident, I spent last summer in Turkey. On the surface, it doesn't seem possible to spend the summer in a country unintentionally, but nevertheless, that is just what I did, not only I, but the roommate, so coyly, according to some bias circles, call my husband, when the simple thing to do would be to call him by his name, Mark, and our 12-year-old, Mr. Big. We left our home near Louisville, Kentucky, the first of May, for a brief holiday in Greece. Like Santa Claus in his most generous mood, the government of Greece had invited us to pay a return visit to their lovely land. Tentatively, they had suggested that we might like to make a trip by freighter. A Greek-American, Mr. Stephen D. Stephanidis, was and is president of the Prudential Steamship Lines, and it could be arranged that we would take one of his cargo ships to Piraeus, the port of Athens, have a visit of 14 or 15 days, and then take the next ship of the Prudential Lines back to the United States. The second freighter, it was explained, would not sail directly for New York, but would make stops of 2 or 3 days to unload cargo in Istanbul, Izmit, and Iskenderun, all Turkish ports. The whole round trip would take about 7 weeks. We accepted enthusiastically. We would adore, at least I would adore, the roommate doesn't use what he terms such extravagant language, revisiting Greece and getting a glimpse of Turkey. We had seen parts of Greece in 1947 during the bitter guerrilla warfare when the roommate served as the United States representative on the United States Commission of Investigation concerning Greek frontier incidents. But neither of us had ever been closer to Turkey than Salonika. Well, the visit to Greece was absolutely perfect to my way of thinking and to the roommates too, except for the minor matter of welcoming committees. The roommate is a modest soul, and he felt the Greeks made too much over us. When we would go on trips about the country, the Greek Foreign Office would alert the governors of the provinces, who were called nomarchs, and with bunches of flowers and military escorts, they would meet us an hour's drive from their provincial seats, shake the roommate's hand, and kiss mine, nobody saying an understandable word, for the nomarch spoke no English and we no Greek to mention, climb into the front seat of our car and accompany us to our destinations. After one especially strenuous day, my Mark mourned, "Oh God, if there's another nomarch, there will be no more Mark." But his blue eyes twinkled and he almost lost his breath with quiet laughter, as is his way when he knocks himself out completely with one of his own witticisms. Of course, no one else's witticisms are ever that funny. So even with no marks, the Greek visit was the most wonderful experience we ever had. Nevertheless, when the 2 weeks for which we had been invited were up, we began to inquire anxiously for our freighter, the Moline Victory, that was to take us home. We didn't want to be like those fish who overstayed their welcome. But the Moline was slightly delayed in New York, we were told. It had been late returning to New York from its previous trip, and besides was loading the heaviest cargo it had ever had. The roommate, Mr. Big, and I conferred about what to do. We must move on, but where? Istanbul, which I had always called Constantinople in spite of the Turks having changed it to Istanbul years ago, was the obvious answer. The Moline, after unloading in Piraeus, would stop next at Istanbul and we could board her there. But how to get to Istanbul? By rail, by air, by sea? That sounds, doesn't it, as if I'm just before hanging out lanterns? I was for rail, and we would see more of the country that way, but the roommate was for sea. Everybody said that the sea trip would be much more comfortable, and the roommate is a stickler for comfort. He has often said his idea of roughing it is staying at the Waldorf. So, of course, we came by sea on a Turkish ship, the Ankara, though the only thing Turkish about it is its owner, the Turkish government. During the war, it was built in Newport News by our government as a hospital ship, and after the war, it was turned over to Turkey and redecorated as a luxury liner by that Fifth Avenue house of Sloan's. It sails between Marseille and Istanbul and vice versa, stopping, I believe, at Genoa, Naples, and Piraeus. Though it was comfortably filled when it reached Piraeus, 1,600 Greeks boarded it there, jamming all the decks except one reserved for the first-class passengers, with their bodies, beddings, baskets, suitcases, and bundles. Mr. Big complained the next morning that those on the deck outside his stateroom whooped, laughed, cried, shouted, and sang the night through, which, knowing the Greeks, sounded reasonable. Fortunately for Mr. Big and the Greeks, there wasn't another night. We sighted Istanbul at the far end of the Sea of Marmara about noon the next day. Now, the Sea of Marmara joins the waters of the Bosporus, though it really is the other way around. The Bosporus flows into the waters of the Marmara just a ripple or two after it has been joined by the Golden Horn. Sounds complicated, doesn't it? Golly, you don't know anything. You should have been there. You can't possibly see where one body of water begins and the other ends. At least I can't. I just know that the three of them form a lovely green shimmering gigantic capital letter Y, with the left prompt much smaller than the right. For the left is a short, slightly curled golden horn flowing between the ancient city of Istanbul and the newer sections of Istanbul called Galata and Pera. But the Bosporus is that very important link connecting the Black Sea to the Sea of Marmara, and thus to the Aegean, and thus to the Mediterranean, and thus to the outside world. As we steam slowly up the stem of the Marmara, the land to our left and directly across our path was Europe, Turkey, small chunk of Europe, rolling and lushly green with innumerable pale gray minarets rocketing above their mosque domes into a cloudless sky. And on our right was Asia, also with rolling sweeps of green grasses and trees and cloud-pricking minarets, but with a goodly number of substantial-looking yellow stucco buildings in the foreground. A long, dowdy, weather-beaten, close to the water was the hospital where Florence Nightingale did her first nursing during the Crimean War, walking the dark halls at night from ward to ward, clutching a sputtering candle, a candle that has become such a symbol of the nursing profession that no trained nurse takes her oath today without holding a similar one in her hands. This meager information I gathered with sweat, blood, and tears from a fellow passenger on the Ankara, a Turk whom I had known 2 years before when the roommate had served with him in the Near East and in Lausanne, Switzerland, on the Palestine Peace Commission. He was one of three Turks on the commission with whom we had associated daily, but to say I had known him is bragging. He was as inscrutable as the Sphinx. When the roommate and I first sighted him on the Ankara, he was sitting by himself in a smoking saloon, his face immobile, his arms and legs crossed. For several seconds, we stared at him in a state of shock, and then the roommate blurted, "God, he hasn't changed expression since Lausanne." The land at the head of Marmara rose steep from the water's edge, and stepladders seemed to span the space from shore to sky. But as we came closer, I saw they were narrow apartment houses with open porches across all floors, perched on irregular ledges. Of course, there were mosques here, too, making with their arched domes and their slim, bracketing minarets, gray stage curtains before the unseen land. The Ankara swung right into the mouth of the Golden Horn and edged towards a space along the quay directly in front of the customs house, which was squirming with people. Hundreds were packed on the terraces of the 4- and 5-story building. They hung over the rails, they skinned up the columns, they stood on one another's shoulders, one another's heads, one another's stomachs, they screeched and screamed and whistled, they waved hats, scarves, baby napkins, coats, pillowcases, and sheets. They were Greeks meeting Greeks, my Turkish friend told me. There were 50,000 Greeks in Turkey, most of them in Istanbul, in spite of Turkey's having done her best, which I'm sure is not bad, to get rid of them. And practically all of them were at the pier this day to welcome long-lost relatives. At least, I took them to be long-lost. Nobody could be so enthusiastic over a relative otherwise. When the ship was finally fast, I hurried down to our stateroom to help the roommate, Mr. Big, gather up the coats and packages. The roommate was beside himself. He had been milling about for an hour in the main saloon to get our passports stamped and retreated defeated. "You try it," he asked me gallantly. "You never saw such pushing and shoving and pulling in your life. And my God, the smell." I kept quiet. I had learned some sense in my 29 years of marriage. "Let him get off." He was still belligerent. "We're in no hurry. We haven't got a damn place to go when we get off. We'll probably be stuck here for 10 days. When he decided that there had been sufficient time for the mob to thin, he ventured out again and returned shortly with the passport stamped. Behind him was an ancient, gaunt man, his face as creased as a long, packed piece of linen, and his clothes ragged, patched, and many sizes too big for him. "Poor, feeble old thing," I thought. "The roommate wants to give him one of his suits." But not at all. He was a porter, called, as I learned later, Hamal, and he had come for our baggage. "He can't have them all," I protested as he began to stack our 7 suitcases in one pile and tie a rope around them. "You tell him," said the roommate sarcastically. "You speak Turkish so well." Helpless, I watched that old creature hoist those suitcases onto his back and walk, doubled half over, off the ship. I ran beside him for a little way, thinking I could steady them if they began to totter. But I soon found myself running beside other hamals with much heavier loads, some carrying trunks, wooden boxes, double beds, and mattresses. One was even carrying a 2-door wardrobe. In the customs shed, the pandemonium was something terrific. For one thing, everybody was speaking a foreign language, such as Turkish, and there were no alphabetical letters under which to wait and no directions that we could read. The roommate, who is a gentleman away from home, was pushed this way and that and all over the place. At first, like any proper wife, I offered helpful suggestions, but when they were ignored, as I should have known they would be, I retired to the rim of a fountain sunk into the floor at the far end of the shed. This, though, was also a mistake. Hamal after Hamal, sweating and panting, threw himself flat on the floor beside me and lapped up water from the basin like a dog. The shed, practically empty, our Turkish friend had long ago departed without murmuring a word, had an official got around to us. "How much money have you?" he asked the roommate. The roommate counted it out for him. It didn't take long. "And you?" he asked me, turning to me. $29. "When I travel, I trust in God," the roommate says. "Have you any gold jewelry?" I mentioned 2 chains, a pin, and a pair of earrings. He made notes in the back of my passport. "Any silver?" "An old Alexander coin and 2 slave bracelets." Again, he made notes. "Any other jewelry?" 2 bracelets with small diamonds set in gold or silver. Platinum. He shrugged and made no notes. They were evidently worthless. A few more questions and we were through. Once more, the hamal loaded himself and we went out into the street, white and blinding with afternoon sun, and took a shabby taxi. We climbed almost vertically up a dozen or so very narrow, twisting streets and drew in front of a rundown building of 5 or 6 stories named, ironically, the Pera Palace, and pronounced the Pera Palace. It was reputed to be Istanbul's 2nd best hotel, with the Park Hotel first. But there were people, as we found out shortly, who disagreed with this rating. The plumbing worked at the Para Palace, and there was always hot water and frequently cold. But at the park, the guests had to ring constantly for maids to come running with buckets of water, either hot or cold, and they weren't particular. The roommates in my room resembled the finest flowering of a madam's proudest decorating achievement. The walls were magenta red, garlanded with gold fruits, flowers, and ribbons, and the bed was brass, the wardrobe, tables, chairs, and whatnots, and I do mean whatnots, were Victorian at its worst, or whatever is the corresponding period in Turkey, and the one bedside lamp had a bowl-shaped, red, sleazy silk shade with tassels. Mr. Big's room was somewhat better. His paper was gray with silver garlands. I, who had always ridiculed the roommate's finickiness about hotel accommodations, thought for a moment I couldn't bear it. But there was one redeeming feature. The bathroom had a window that opened onto a view of the Golden Horn. Not stopping to unpack, I dragged a chair to that window, took my seat, and planted my elbows on the sill. So help me, my hours at the Para Palace would be spent right there. That's the end of chapter 1.